This is a podcast for Thursday, February 17th, 2011, Theories of Reality. And today we're going to begin early, arguments for God's existence. And so the three main arguments we'll be talking about is the ontological argument, which we'll talk about today, the cosmological argument, and the teleological argument, also known as the design argument. So just a brief announcement before we get started. Let's see. The extra credit essay is due a week from tomorrow, February 25th. And this ongoing midterm exam, when is the last day to take the exam?
Next Thursday,
the 24th. So next Thursday, a week from today, is the last day to take the exam. And next Friday, February 25th, is the last day to turn in the extra credit essay. I think I gave you till 11:55, if you like, on Friday. And then next Friday is also the last day to change your grading option to pass, no pass, or letter grade, or drop the class. And don't forget that Monday is a holiday. So you have it's President's Day, so you have a three-day weekend coming up. All the labs, if you're planning on taking the test, all the labs are closed on Monday, and campus will be closed on Monday. So, and the library will be closed on Monday. Everything is closed, so don't come here. You're going to be like hassled by security when you're driving around campus looking for a building to go into. They'll think you're a vagrant or something. Or at least that's what they've told me when I've been around here during holiday weekends. Might be something. It might be a different reaction to you depending on what you look like. Okay. Okay, so let's talk a little bit in general about God's existence. So in talking about God's existence, you see a couple of common fallacies. And one fallacy is this idea that God's existence is subjective. Whether a person believes in God's existence is a matter of their own consciousness and what beliefs they hold. So obviously, whether you believe in God or not is relative to your beliefs. It depends on what the contents of your consciousness are. A belief is a sort of propositional attitude that you have towards some posited truth. So when someone says God exists, you either assent to that proposition, which means that you think reality contains such a being, or you dissent from that proposition, meaning that you say there is no such being in reality. Or you might take a middle position and you might neither assent nor dissent, but you might say, well, you're not really sure, and so you, vote present, like the president used to do when he was a senator. So you can just be withhold judgment, right? So you can say, well, I don't assent to the proposition that it is true. I don't assent to the proposition God exists, but I don't believe it. I don't dissent from it. I don't disbelieve it. I just don't have a belief one way or another. I'm withholding judgment. And you do that. You can do that for any proposition, right? If you agree that it's true, then you say, I believe this. If you think that it's false, you say, I positively disbelieve this, or I believe this is false. It's sort of the same thing. And so in God's existence, you have theism, not used as much as atheism. Usually the negative is used more. Theism is kind of like a more of a technical, philosophical term that's not used in general language. But theism is belief in God. Atheism is disbelief in God. And then you have agnosticism, which is you're not really sure one way or the other. Don't confuse agnosticism with Gnosticism, which was an ancient Greek mystery religion which mixed with Christianity and was a kind of a heretical offshoot of early Christianity. So to be an agnostic means literally you don't know. It means no knowledge in Greek. Whereas atheism just means no God. And then theism just means God. So either God exists or God... So if you're thinking about reality, the metaphysical proposition, the proposition God exists is either true or false. If you believe that God exists, you're a theist. If you believe God doesn't exist, you're an atheist. If you don't know, then you're a, or you're not sure, then you're an agnostic. But think about this for a moment. If to say that God exists means that God exists for me, and it just means I believe God exists, and it's not about external reality, but it's about your own beliefs. And if you say, well, God exists to you if you believe it, and God doesn't exist to him if he doesn't believe it, what about the agnostic? What if God might or might not exist to him? Either there is such a being who's omnipotent and omniscient and the creator of the world and so on and so forth, or there isn't such a being. So you qualify what you mean by God first. And then once you qualify what you mean by God, you've defined your terms, then you have a meaningful proposition. Aristotle's law of excluded middle that says for any meaningful, well-qualified proposition, it is either true or false. There's no middle ground. Now, whether we can know whether it's true or false is a separate matter. But when you're talking about the metaphysical truth of the matter, either God exists or he doesn't. And it's possible that God exists and there'd be no way for us to know it. It's also possible that it's possible that God exists and there's no way to know it. It's also possible that God doesn't exist and there is a way to know it, or combinations of those. So whether it's how hard it is to find out something, it's a separate matter from whether it's true or not. It's just the difference between truth and knowledge. It's always been true that there's this big ball of mostly ice floating around the solar system in elliptical orbit, the ninth planet, first dubbed Planet X, later renamed Pluto. Later, in a humiliating astronomical catastrophe, demoted from a planet to what, dwarf planet or some other name for it, planetary-like body. I can't remember what it's named. Any astronomy buffs, tell me what's Pluto's official classification? It's been demoted from planet to something less than a planet.
Planetoid,
yeah. But the thing is, regardless of how we classify Pluto, Pluto's always been out there. Now, the first time somebody laid their eyes on the planet Pluto, a human being laid their eyes on the planet Pluto, was in around 1930, right? It was really hard to see Pluto because if you're like Ugg the caveman and you look up at the sky, you don't see the planet Pluto, right? So we needed really, really good telescopes to be able to see Pluto. Pluto's always been there. So think about God in the same way. Whether or not we can find out whether God exists, God is either there or he's not. Yeah?
Do you think we can realistically think about God like a soda can or a planet or this object that has like localized existence? I mean, that's one possibility that could be, but I think that it's like, when dealing with the topic of God, like just what exactly you're trying to define is...
I see what you mean. Yeah, so then the question comes, is God localized or is he non-localized? That's a well-qualified, meaningful proposition, as long as we define what we mean by localized. Before you figure out whether there is a God, you'd want to think about, well, what do we mean by God? But that question is, do you think we can really think about God like a soda can or a localized phenomenon? The question, is God localized? I think is a meaningful question. We might have to talk about what we mean by localized. I mean, sometimes people say God is omnipresent or something. That idea. But then the question is, what does it mean to exist, I suppose? And existence isn't necessarily limited to physical things. The soda can is a physical thing. But if there's say if you have an immortal soul, that soul, either you have a soul or you don't. And we can decide what we mean by soul if we say, you know, some entity which is not made of matter, which is the vehicle of consciousness, say. Then we can have a discussion about whether or not that entity exists or not. And either you have a soul of that sort or you don't. And God is in the same way. The idea that, and you can sort of flesh out what you mean by God, or you might even talk about whether particular conceptions of God are correct or not. But if you just think about, there is a kind of a generic concept of God which is common to Western religion, but not Eastern religion. Eastern religion has some sort of a different concept of God, which I think we're going to talk about at the end of Arguments for God's Existence. But if we're thinking about a personal God, you know, the Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and I think sort of Americans generally and people in Western culture who don't have any particular religious belief of a particular religious tradition still have this sort of Judeo-Christianish God of the philosophers, who's all-knowing and all-powerful and morally benevolent, creator of the universe. And he's, you know, the God of the deists and the God of people that sort of, they have a kind of Americanized version of Christianity, which is sort of all the Christian elements have dropped out. And it's kind of like, there's this being and he wants us all to play nice. And maybe he sent the Ten Commandments to Moses and he sent Jesus to tell people to behave themselves. And when you die, everybody goes to heaven. And so you get this sort of abstract kind of version of Christianity. And you get the same sort of idea, though, in Plato, this idea of a being who's all-powerful and all-knowing and morally perfect and created the universe and, you know, has moral requirements for human beings and that there's some sort of afterlife associated with him. Yeah?
If that type of God does exist, that localized, kind of personified God, I would say that it would have to be feminine in nature if it resembles humans at all, because females in our, you know, in our bodies are the only ones capable of creation. So if God had some, you know, act of creation other than just being sperm, provided the sperm for the egg of creation, then it would have to be feminine or female.
Well, I think it would have to be neither feminine nor masculine if it created both feminine and masculine.
I'm just saying if it has any creative powers, those would be...
You'd attribute it a feminine in reference to gender, but not in reference to sex, right?
Correct.
Okay, so you're talking the act is more of a feminine act. But
of creation. And in gender, even, I mean, the human beings, all we provide is a sperm. Well, we provide a few million sperm, and one of 50 happens to get there. But the female provides the egg and actually gives birth.
If you want to follow that strictly, don't you need two?
Yeah. Two sperm?
No, a male and a female.
Two gods.
But the female
like male
is responsible for the cultivation of the new life form.
Yes,
the sperm. The female can't reproduce by herself.
Without a sperm. I mentioned the sperm.
Right, but if you're assuming, you're talking about the female being the vehicle of reproduction, and it takes two to tango.
Creation.
Right. So, to follow your analogy, it seems like if we're going to take that seriously, that really you need like a female deity, like an earth mother, and her consort, like the storm god, right?
You know? So, I guess the truth is, I didn't want you to take it seriously.
Okay.
I can't really take that concept of God seriously at all myself. A personified, actual, you know, lightning bolt beard kind of god. It would be impossible.
But the idea of a personal god isn't necessarily like Zeus. I mean, you start out with these early primitive forms of god, like, and like you said, you had the earth mother and the storm god or a sky god, and he would impregnate the earth mother, and she'd give birth to all the crops, and it would seem like human beings. And sometimes you'll get these myths, and usually in the ancient myths, things are created through war or sex. Those are the two. You know, love and war are the two creators, right? Yeah. But you know, this idea that the man with the beard and the guy throwing the lightning bolts down, that's different from the idea of a personal god. The idea of a personal god is the idea of an infinite mind. It's the idea of a being who is personal in the sense that he is a conscious being and not a force.
Not necessarily personified. like a beard, enlightenable, etc., with human, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, just as
personal in the sense of a thinking conscience,
consciousness,
powerful acting, etc.
Right.
So a thinking God, then.
Yeah. Aristotle actually defined God as his idea, and Aristotle's view was sort of eccentric, I think, but it was typical of ancient Greek philosophy. He said God is thought thinking itself. Literally in Greek, it's thinking, thinking, thinking. So it's God is a being of pure thought. What is God thinking about? Well, the only object worthy of his thought is, of course, himself, because he's the most perfect thing there is. And then what is he, what activity is he going about? He's thinking. So actually, I get that back out of order. So God is a being of pure thought. He's going about a particular kind of activity. What activity is he engaged in? Thinking, right? So he's pure thought thinking. What is he thinking about? He's thinking about himself, because that's the only object worthy of his contemplation. So God is thought thinking itself, or thinking, thinking about thinking. Which is, you know, again, the sort of idea of God is almost an abstraction. Although, if you look at these arguments for God's existence, most of them, the Thomas Aquinas' classic arguments are all cribbed from Aristotle. And Aristotle's the one that first came up with the unmoved mover argument for God's existence, the sort of first cause argument that the cosmological argument is based on. So I think that if you're thinking about God as a personal being, that doesn't necessitate that God has a physical form, that even that God has emotions, you're not positing particular attributes about God, or that God has gender either. So people commonly think that this is a subjective thing. So the first thing I want to get out of the way is that any meaningful proposition, well qualified and defined, must either be true or false. So it doesn't depend on what you believe, just as any other fact of reality doesn't depend on what you believe. And there's a distinction between whether it's true and whether we can know it, or whether we can find out, and how difficult that is. And in medieval philosophy and theology, there's a distinction made between what's known as natural theology and biblical theology, or revealed theology. And so in natural theology, you're attempting to know God through reason. To know, and what can you know through reason? Generally speaking, the medieval philosophers thought you could know that God exists. And maybe a few things about God, like that God is very powerful, that he is highly intelligent, and that he's benevolent. Those are sort of three ideas. And then it's thought that you might know some other things, like that God doesn't have a body, or that God is an eternal being. But you can't know a lot of the particulars about God. But you can know some things about God, the fact that he exists, and his general essence or nature, to a degree. But the argument was that you need to go to the Bible to find out that God isn't just a very powerful being, but he's all-powerful or omnipotent. That God is not just highly intelligent, but he's omniscient. And that that God is, you know, perfectly morally good, might be a third. And then particular facts of religious belief, like that God was incarnate in Christ. So that's one that Anselm, who's the person that wrote the two books that the ontological argument is based on. And St. Anselm wrote this book called, you know, Why Did God Become Man? And one of the points he makes there is that natural theology can never know, you know, that God became a man, or if it's assumed that God became a man in the person of Jesus, why he became a man. So that is left to revelation. And reason is impotent to know the truth of revelation. But reason can still know that God exists and that God has a certain sort of nature or essence. It just can't know the particular facts of theology. And, of course, this is all within the context of Christianity. There were a few Muslim theologians like Averroes and a couple of Jews, Maimonides, but mostly you're talking about Christians in Western Europe who were doing natural theology at the time, and they all are pretty much on the same page on this. And Thomas Aquinas, who's in the reading, is, you know, makes this a lot of bones about this distinction between natural theology and revealed or biblical theology in that case. Any questions about any of that so far?
I don't think I quite understand the difference yet.
Okay. What can reason know is the question people in the Middle Ages were asking. What can you know about God? And I think it's also a kind of caricature to think that, you know, religious people think, well, you just have to have a blind leap of faith and you just, you know, go on, you know, whatever. You just, there's no way of knowing anything with reason. And maybe reason is you should look on it with suspicion. And historically, that's not the way Christians have looked on it, nor Jews. Historically, the idea is that reason can know certain things about God, but it can't know the details.
Is that natural theology?
So natural theology is concerned with proving God's existence and knowing God's nature through reason. And sometimes natural theology is just known as philosophy of religion. So in philosophy of religion, you're not generally poring over sacred texts. What you're doing is you're getting pro and con arguments. And a lot of this happened because a lot of the early church fathers in Christianity liked philosophy. And they read a lot of philosophers and wanted to apply philosophy, which was all about attempt to come to a systematic picture of the world through the use of reason, and apply that to theology. And again, throughout the history of Christianity, there's this idea that reason can prove God exists. Reason can prove certain facts about God, his essence and nature, in broad outline. But it takes revelation to teach you the particular truths about God, and most importantly, the way to salvation. So you can't reason your way to Jesus died for the sins of mankind. But you can reason yourself to, you know, God, you know, created me, and I owe an allegiance to him because of that, and there are certain moral commandments, and there's this idea of in morality, too, this idea of a natural law, that there are certain moral laws that a person ought to follow. And so there's a lot of, again, kind of broad outline of God and your moral duties, and but to get the particulars, you need to go to Revelation, to you know, the inspired word of God, the Bible, you know, according to the Western theologians. Okay, so just to come back here to this not subjective, I should talk a little bit about faith and reason, even though this isn't an epistemology class. But the idea of faith, according to the medievalists, and I think to a lot of, you know, Christians today, and particularly the intellectual sort and the theologians, is that you don't need faith for natural theology. It's based on reason. To know God through revelation, that's where faith comes in. So that's the one distinction that's made, is knowing God through reason versus knowing God through faith. And some theologians might add in sort of personal experiences and spiritual experiences with God too, being part of faith, a kind of subjective knowing. So the ontological argument, again, part of natural theology, it is an a priori argument. What is an a priori argument, you ask?
No, without experience.
Yeah, it's an argument which is based on pure reason and not the senses. It's a, you could call it a conceptual argument. It's an argument based on, which is not based on empirical evidence or the senses. So it's a conceptual or a purely logical argument.
Or a definition, right?
Yeah, or a definitional argument, if you like. And an example of, think about an a priori truth. A bachelor is an unmarried male. To find out whether all bachelors are unmarried males, do you take a survey, go door to door and say, excuse me, could I ask you a few questions? You know, are you a bachelor? It's like, oh, yes, I am. You know, are you married? What is this, like a trick question? No, I'm not married. I'm a bachelor. And am I right assuming that you were male? You know, and they say, you pervert, get out of here. What's the matter with you? So you think like you're pulling somebody's leg, right? If you know what a bachelor is, you know you're unmarried and you know you're male, because that's what a bachelor is. And so when you say a bachelor is an unmarried male, you're just unpacking that subject. The predicate belongs in the subject. It's kind of hiding in there. If I say bachelor, you're thinking unmarried male. It's built into that word bachelor that the concepts of unmarriedness and maleness participate in the concept of bachelorhood, if you like. And so the ontological argument argues in the same way that hidden in that concept of God is the concept of existence. And if you think about what it is to be God and what the word God means hard enough, you'll see that part of that concept is of a being which must exist. Not that might exist or could exist, but has to exist. And so God is seen as a being which exists by definition. And so God not only does exist, but he couldn't possibly not exist according to this argument. It's called the ontological argument because it has to do with being or existence. So the Greek word ontos means being or existence. So this is the existence argument for God's existence. And so like the a bachelor's and unmarried male, it's a priori in the sense that you're not going down to the local Pentecostal church to see if there really are faith healings. You're not looking DNA molecule and trying to figure out whether it could have come about through random chance or whether it requires a divine designer. You're not studying astrophysics to try to find out what there was before the Big Bang. You're just thinking about the concept of God and thinking about the concept of existence and seeing if you can imagine one without the other conceptually. And again, the argument from Descartes and from St. Anselm is that if you think about God hard enough, the sentence "God exists" it will become as clear to you as the sentence "a triangle has three sides." And just as being, has three sides is an essential property of triangles, you'll see that exists is an essential property of God. That you can't even understand the concept of God without understanding that existence is a part of that concept. And God is unlike any other concept in that it necessarily exists in reality once you understand the concept. So that's some broad outline of the argument. Here's Descartes' version. So I'm going to give you two versions. One is from René Descartes, who we had in the mind-body problem. And the other one is from St. Anselm, medieval theologian. Descartes' version is a little more simple, so we're going to start with his. So this is, because it's an a priori argument, it's a deductive argument. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. This is a sort of argument like, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore, Socrates is mortal. The premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. So this is a deductive argument. So, and deductive arguments guarantee that their conclusion is true as long as the premises are true. So we'll see whether that's the case with this. So God is a perfect being. So you think about the concept of God. One thing that people agree with God is that he doesn't make mistakes, right? If you think about what most people mean by God, he's a sort of ultimate being, and he's not caught unawares, and he doesn't screw up. He's a perfect being. If he made mistakes and screwed up and had flaws, character flaws, mistakes in judgment, the weaknesses, he wouldn't really be God. A perfect being must contain all perfections. So this is just unpacking what the word perfect means, right? If God was missing something that would make him better, he wouldn't really be perfect, right? Because part of the notion of perfect is the notion of being complete. So if God had every great making quality or perfect making quality, and there was one that was sort of left out, then it wouldn't really be perfect. Like if it's I think of it, the perfect car, right? So yeah, if you have the perfect car, you say this is a perfect car, and it, you know, it runs really smooth, and it has great acceleration, and it it has really good heating system, which just comes in really handy, you know, and good handling, right? Looks really sweet. But if like it doesn't have an MP3 player or something, right? Or maybe it doesn't even have a stereo. You think, well, that's not the perfect car. So if it's missing something, it's not really the perfect car. The perfect car would have to have all the features that would make it, you know, better. Perfect making qualities. So in the same way, God is thought to have all these perfections. He must have all perfections to be an absolutely perfect being. So then the argument says one of these perfections is existence, because what kind of God would he be if he didn't exist? That wouldn't be a very perfect God. So the idea is that an existing God is more perfect than a non-existing God. So therefore, if you understand that perfection, a perfect being must contain all perfections, and existence is a perfection, then you recognize that God has to exist in reality. Yeah, Jesse.
To claim something as perfect, don't you have to have an imperfection to compare it against?
Sure, I was picking a human being.
But if existence is a perfection and we are included in existence,
then we have a perfection.
But we're not. Then we are a perfection. We don't have.
We have a perfection because our judgment is flawed, our physical lifespan is flawed, all our perceptions are flawed.
Yeah, it's not saying that last premise there is not saying that everything which exists is perfect. It's saying that it's more perfect to exist than not to exist.
Is it kind of saying that God would be the all-encompassing, which is what makes it perfect, when people are just one fragment of existence?
No.
God is all of existence?
That's Hinduism. Descartes wasn't a Hindu.
Okay. But that's what I was saying.
No, but the idea is that it's more perfect to exist than not to exist. It's the argument. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry that you had your hand raised. It's better to... So the idea is that... think about two beings, okay? Which is a more perfect being? A God that really exists, or a God who's a figment of your imagination? Well, obviously the more perfect one, Descartes would say, is the, you know, the existing God. And existence... It's an existing being is more perfect. And this is kind of a difficult notion. This goes back to like Platonism, where Plato has this idea of degrees of reality, and he thinks you kind of start out with like things that don't, that kind of have a pseudo existence, like shadows and reflections of things and images or pictures of things, and then you sort of move up the ladder and you have physical objects, and those are kind of more real, and then you have things like human beings. You have your consciousness and are sort of a step up from inanimate matter. And then finally you have this idea of the spiritual world, which is the most real. And there's this idea of gradations of being, and things go up the scale, they get more real and they become more perfect. So in the realm of ideas, you have the concept of perfect justice, which is the most perfect. And then, you know, with human beings are imperfect in justice, right? They have imperfections in their moral character. And then I suppose you might have, like, a story about justice, which is even less perfect, because it's not even a story about, it's not even justice in any incarnation. It's kind of a reflection of justice. So to this idea of degrees of reality is kind of built into Descartes' thinking about these ideas of perfection. The more perfect something is, the more real it is, and the less perfect it is, the less real it is. So if you think about like a reflection, like say in a lake of a mountain, right? It's kind of hazy and shimmery. It's sort of a pale reflection of the reality. It doesn't really have substance, and so it's less real, and it's also to that degree less perfect. Or it's a flawed representation of the mountain. And then so when he's thinking about the concept of perfection, he says a perfect being, unlike any other being, would have to exist in reality. Otherwise, it wouldn't be truly perfect. Yeah.
Does Descartes believe that God created people?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, if people aren't perfect, God created them. Is that a flaw of God, or is that a flaw of people?
No, people are like a shadow. God is like the rock. I think that's another one of Descartes' metaphors that he gives.
Why would God create a shadow that's imperfect if he's, or it is perfect? Well, I'm just confused of the supposition of perfect, I guess.
Well, I think the idea is that God created human beings with free will, and human beings misuse that.
So it's it's basically another Christian ethos, a Christian idea. It's based on Christianity.
Yeah, I mean,
sounds like Christianity, or at least Western philosophy.
This particular argument here isn't particularly Christian, but then you're asking further questions like, well, if God's perfect, why does the world suck? And then it's like, well, okay, let's see, go back to
that.
Here's one thing, it was like the free will thing. But there are people that believe that free will is the explanation for the problem of evil who aren't Christians. So it's not a particularly Christian. You don't have to have the whole Garden of Eden thing and the magic fruit and the talking snake to think that human beings were created in some good state and that they sort of became alienated or estranged from God.
What about original sin? Is that kind of the idea of original sin? It just seems rooted in that philosophy to me. It seems rooted in a...
Well, see, you're asking a separate question. I think you're asking, if God's perfect, why does the world have so many flaws?
Or why... I'm not even sure the world does have flaws, actually, but that's what we seem to be saying. I kind of see the world as perfect, actually.
I didn't say anything about the world.
Okay. But that's what Descartes...
I mean, you gave an objection, so I gave like a one response.
Right.
But then there could be other responses.
Yeah.
You could say, God sort of creates this kind of chain of being or something, and stuff on the lower end of the chain is only reflecting the greatness of stuff further up, and so it's necessarily going to be flawed and imperfect, because it's kind of a reflection of a more perfect order or something. If God was going to create something perfect, he could clone himself or something. But he couldn't. Human beings, because they're material and because they're not pure spirit and because they're not, like God in every respect. Descartes might say to the degree that human beings differ from God, they're going to be less perfect and liable to flaws.
But he is saying they do differ.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Jesse.
Is it unreasonable to think that maybe we've been tricked into thinking that our Creator is God when, the two go, are talked about simultaneously whenever you talk about God, it's assumed as the Creator, and the Creator is assumed as God, but I mean, there's nothing really that is the basis for that reasoning.
Well, I think part of the definition of God is like creator of the universe. Because if God himself didn't create the universe, if he used a middleman, you think about him using a middleman or something, or I'm not sure what you're thinking of.
Well, I mean, a human being can create a city and,
the human being's always been here and God's kind of managing us, or... God have?
There's the possibility of an inferior being able to create a whole universe, especially now with virtual technology that we have. I mean, it's not impossible to think that in the future you could create a whole virtual universe that's self-sustaining. This computer program that could eventually become conscious of itself to some degree, but the creator of that universe is maybe no more superior or intelligent or benevolent than its creation.
I mean you get this idea actually in ancient Gnosticism, where there's this idea that there's this certain there's this spiritual being who sort of gets confused and forgets who he is, and he gets this complex where he actually thinks he's God, and then he creates the earth and everything in it, which is just like a total train wreck. And he thinks he's God, and because he thinks he's God, he thinks he has to create all this stuff. But because he doesn't know what the heck he's doing, because he's not really God, he makes all these mistakes, and that explains why the world's so screwed up, according to Gnosticism. And God's seen, he's called like this being who's, you know, God in quotes, isn't the true God. He's this sort of delusional God or false God who's called the blind fool, I think is one of his names. And so that, I mean, that's one I suppose possibility. We're just going through the sort of general, the Judeo-Christian picture, because that's the God that most people think about, at least in America, when they're thinking about the concept of God, the kind of Judeo-Christian God. Let's just move on to Anselm's version of the ontological argument. So Anselm's version is a little different from Descartes in that it takes the form of an indirect proof. So in logic, you call this a reductio ad absurdum, which means reduced to an absurdity. And so what you do is try to show that your opponent's view is somehow contradictory. That if you assume your opponent's view of true, you show that logically it implies something which is contradictory or false, or at least something which is highly questionable, and therefore the view, anything which implies a contradiction is false. So if you have a belief, and that belief logically implies that some other belief which is known to be false or highly unlikely or, you know, just blatantly contradictory, then that belief itself has to be false. So that's the way indirect proof works. Instead of trying to prove your case, you try to prove the other guy's case is wrong. And then in case of God, it's pretty easy. It's like either God exists or God doesn't exist. If God doesn't exist is false, then God exists has to be true. Just to give you an example of indirect proof or a reductio ad absurdum, how this sort of argument might go. Let me just say. So think about someone arguing that morality is relative. And so a person might say, well, you know, I think morality is relative. What you believe is right for you. And what I believe is right for me. And there is no objective morality. It's all a matter of what you believe. And whatever you believe is good and right for you might not be good and right for somebody else. You say, okay, let's assume that that's true. Well, what does that imply? I did this in one of my, it was a 202 class, I think. So there's this woman that sat in front, and she was sure that morality was relative. And so I said, okay, let's see what follows from your belief. Do you have any kids? And she's kind of an older woman. She said, you know, I've got a daughter. So it'd be okay for me to have sex with your daughter. She's 6 years old. I'm like, yeah, I like them young, right? What's wrong with that? And she's like, I can't believe you're saying that. I'm like, well, I'm just going from your premise, right? You said that whatever. You know, if I believe it's right for me, then maybe I like having sex with little children. But, you know, that's her view. So anyway, the argument in the reductio is that you say, okay, you start saying, well, morality's relative, let your conscience be your guide, do what's right for you. And you think, oh, that sounds pretty good. But then you start think, okay, well, where does that lead? Oh, well, that means what if someone thinks it's right to murder and rape and kill and abuse other people and destroy their property and cause suffering for their own amusement, right? Well, that's a horrible view. And so so you would have to believe it's either contradictory to say that it's, you know, moral to rape, kill, torture, right? You might say it might be a contradiction, or it just might be totally unbelievable that someone would hold that view. It's totally implausible. So you might not get a formal contradiction, but that's a pretty tough bull to bite. And she wasn't willing to bite it. So that's an example of a reductio. So how does Anselm apply this to God's existence? So he says, assume God doesn't exist. So he quotes one of the Psalms. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And Anselm says, the guy really is a fool because he's asserting a contradiction. Why? He's saying God doesn't really exist. God exists only in the mind. So what does this mean? Well, who is God? God is the greatest conceivable being. And Anselm says, you think about the concept of God, you ask people what they mean by God, they say he was this sort of ultimate being, the greatest being imaginable. Anselm uses this long Latin phrase, a being than which none greater can be conceived. So for short, we're going to call him the greatest conceivable being, or GCB. So the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. Therefore, if on this hypothesis, again, we're following the logical conclusion, the logical implications of atheism. So the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. That's what the atheist is asserting. Okay. If that's true, then there has to be a greater being, which exists not only in the mind, but in reality as well. Right? Because if you're thinking about, there could be, and this is actually, I should say, there. If you think about the greatest being you can conceive of, if you can conceive of an imaginary God, you can conceive of a being just like the imaginary one, but which also exists in reality, which would be greater, right? So you think about which is greater, an imaginary God or a real God. Well, the real God's going to be greater. So the one that only exists in your mind isn't the greatest. So the atheist is saying the greatest concealed being exists only in the mind. But the greatest concealed being can't exist only in the mind, because there could be a greater one which exists in reality, which you can also conceive of. So therefore, when you say the greatest being exists only in the mind, you're really saying the greatest conceivable being isn't really the greatest conceivable being. Because you're saying God is the greatest conceivable being. The greatest conceivable being, God, only exists in your mind. But if he only exists in your mind, he's not the greatest. So you're saying the greatest conceivable being isn't the greatest conceivable being. And that's a formal contradiction. You're saying A is not A. That's like saying this mouse is not this mouse. It's a formal contradiction. So since atheism leads to a contradiction, atheism must be false. And if atheism is false, then theism is true, and so God exists in reality. Jesse?
I kind of have this idea of a different definition of atheism. So, like, if God is omnipresent or in everything, or if there is no not God,
Do you disagree that God's the greatest concealed being?
No, this has been disproven by Anselm's version. It's the greatest.
This is like a premise. I mean, this is a controversial premise. You think about like the term God. Does God mean, or is an essential property of the definition of God the greatest being you can imagine, or the greatest concealed being?
I don't think God is the greatest conceivable being.
Then why call him God?
I don't think we could conceive of God.
Okay, you can't conceive of God.
Can you go to the next slide?
Because it would just, like, you would still have a percentage of error. You couldn't have 100% conceptual accuracy of God. It's impossible.
We're not talking about, like, you know, the knowing all the details of God accurately. We're just talking about the greatest being you can imagine.
Well, I mean, there's, like, not error, but doubt. There's still a margin of doubt that you might be in error in conceiving of what being correct in what you're conceiving.
But you might be mistaken about the facts of God, but you wouldn't be confused about the fact that this being that you're imagining, he's the greatest being, and that's God, because that's what God means.
I'm just really confused on how, like, if an atheist believes that only God exists in your mind.
Yeah.
And because he exists in your mind, then he must exist in reality. Is that what they're saying?
This is a typo on one of these lines here. So, this should say, and I can't change this when it's on here. This says, therefore, but if God exists, the greatest concealed being exists only in mind. But there could be a greater being which exists in the mind, not only in the mind, but in reality as well. So this should say, instead of there is, there could be. or actually, there is a being you can conceive. There is a greater being you can conceive of, which exists not only in the mind, but in reality as well. So you could put it two ways. But you could say there could be a greater being, which exists not just in the mind, but in reality as well. So that might be the best way to put it. There could be a greater being. In other words, if you say God exists only in the mind, you could imagine a God that exists not only in your mind, but in reality as well, right? Which would be greater? Well, obviously, the being that exists in your mind and reality is greater than the being that just exists in your mind. So that shows the one that just exists in your mind isn't really the greatest, right? Because you could imagine another one that's greater. And then that greater one would be the greatest field being.
But it has to exist.
And he would have to exist, right? So what you're saying really, and this really comes down to this sort of right here. When you say the greatest concealed being exists only in the mind, you're saying the greatest concealed being isn't the greatest conceivable being. Because if he only exists in your mind, he wouldn't be the greatest. Right? if he only exists in your mind, then he's not the greatest one you can imagine. Because you can imagine one just like the one you think only exists in your mind, but is in reality as well. And that would be the greatest one. And that one would exist. So the greatest concealed being exists by definition. Yeah.
When did Anselm write this verse?
He's like 11th century.
Yeah, what about Descartes? Descartes was
1644?
Yeah, so Descartes 17th century. I think he wrote the Meditations 1636, 1642. I think Discourse in the Method, I'm thinking, but 1630, 1640.
1596 to 1650.
Okay, yeah. So he wrote a lot of the stuff. So they're both, you know, Anselm is writing in the Middle Ages and Descartes in the beginning of the Renaissance. Or maybe the middle of the Renaissance, I guess, depending on
where you study.
Yeah.
Are there any logical arguments against that?
Yeah, so logical arguments against this. So what do you think?
I mean, if it's analytic by definition, what's the argument against it?
Yeah, anybody want to take a shot at this? What would be an argument against this? There's a couple mentioned in the text. Like, one is like Kant's argument.
What does Kant say?
So Kant says that there's no difference in the concept between a real $100 and an imaginary $100. And that there's a kind of conceptual confusion going on here. And his whole thing, he says existence isn't a necessary predicate. So his idea is that because it's not a real predicate.
There's one right there.
That's right. Oh wow.
Yeah.
It's a miracle.
Keep that one in your pocket. Tilly's wrong. Unless it's marker.
Now why does it suck all the time?
Or we can put the word property. Predicate's a linguistic term. Property is a metaphysical term. Mm-hmm. So you think about, I give this example of like trying to sell you my car, right? And I have like this, you have things and properties. So you might have a thing, you know, my car, and it's got properties which describe the ways in which it exists. So the thing is my car, that's the object, and that's a thing that either exists or doesn't. And then you have properties like being champagne in color. It's 17 years old, 206,000 miles.
Is that really your car?
Yeah.
Nice.
It's, you know, and it's stick shift or whatever.
Manual.
So, and then, and I say, you know, and since you're a student, you know, and I know you guys are don't have a lot of money to throw around, I'll give you a special deal on it. I'll sell it to you for $500.
Seriously?
So,
is it Toyota?
No. And you know that it's just got like one problem with it though. After you give me the money, I say, you know, there's one thing that I forgot to mention. I'm sure it's kind of a minor thing. It doesn't exist. All right, so.
That's great.
And what Kant says is it's a mistake to put this here. Existence is a proper, as a existence applies to a thing and its property together. So my car, as I describe it, either it exists or it doesn't. Kant talks about the concept of my car as being instantiated in reality. So I have the concept of my car, I describe it, either it exists or it doesn't. You can't put existence as a property like being champagne colored or, you know, being 17 years old. It's not, existence isn't a property. Existence is a feature of a thing and its properties together. And what it means to exist is that the world contains such a thing.
With
the concept, the concept has substance.
Right. With its properties.
With its properties together. Yeah. Existence isn't itself a property, is his argument.
The car have to exist for any of those things to be true?
Yeah, at least as an idea.
But only as an idea, right? Like, only in the same sense that Sherlock Holmes exists.
Well, no. It's basically saying at least as an idea, it has to exist. So God as an idea has to exist, essentially. If you can't get rid of the idea of God because it already exists.
Yeah. Okay. I think...
So he's just looking at the properties, whereas Anselm and Descartes were looking at the implications. He's trying to take existence and putting it into a property when Anselm was trying to put it into the implications. Well, if God is an idea, then what does that imply?
I think that what Kant's saying is that Anselm is smuggling existence into the definition of God when it doesn't belong there. He tries to make existence an essential property of God, but existence isn't a property. It's a kind of category mistake to make existence into a property. Existence is something which describes whether a concept has representation in the real world or not. It is not itself a property. It describes whether properties and properties and objects together are part of the real world or they aren't.
Sherlock Holmes does exist. He's not a person, but he's a character. He exists. I mean, I
just say as a concept.
I think Kant's making there that he's confusing existence with is real.
I think that he'd say those are synonymous.
See, I'd say that he's making a mistake because exist means to just exist. I mean, either as an idea or in a physical representation, but at minimal an idea.
So, well, to exist as an idea is just to be a concept.
So everything exists. That we know everything exists. But to be real would mean exists also as an idea as well as in reality.
I see. So you're saying like ideas exist in some sense, otherwise they wouldn't be anything.
Yeah, so existence is an implication, not a... I think, is a straw man argument. I think he's trying to say that Anselm and Descartes were putting it as property, whereas it's an implication. So he's trying to say, well, existence, and then he's knocking down the argument of the existence of the property, but that's really not the argument at hand. It's a straw man. So I think there's a difference between exists and being real. Because everything that we know of exists by definition, but being real means to exist not only as concept in our head, but as well as a reality.
I think you could use the same. I mean, people talk about like Sherlock Holmes isn't real, but he exists as a concept. Well, couldn't a person say God isn't real, but he exists just as a concept?
But then you get back to Anselm's, he wouldn't be the greatest conceivable being.
Right, and so what Kant would say is that
See, I think the definition of greatest conceivable being means that existing both as an idea and as a reality are a definition of God.
Yeah.
The fact that if he did live in like reality, it would just be another concept. Does that make sense? Like,
I see what you mean. Yeah, the idea of an existing God is just—it's just another concept. It's not God actually existing.
Yeah,
is the argument.
Yeah.
So I think the idea is there's a confusion going on according to Kant between the definition of a thing and whether it exists. Once you define a certain thing, then you can try to figure out whether it exists. But you got to keep the concept of the thing and the reality of the thing separate, because if you take existence and just make it one of the properties and define the thing you're talking about in existence, that's kind of cheating.
Well, no, existence is implied. I think that's the problem. Uh-huh. I think existence, whether an idea or a reality, is implied. It has to exist if you're talking about it.
So is existence a like a property, like being green or square?
No, existence isn't a property. Existence is an implication. As soon as you say my car, it exists, if merely as an idea.
Okay, well, that merely as an idea seems like an important qualifier.
No, but that's the point of his argument. If it's merely as an idea, then it's not the greatest conceivable.
Greatest conceivable being?
Yeah.
So I think you would say that...
It has to have properties... Or the thing, it just has to
be real
in the mind or in the spirit.
Well, the point that he's trying to argue is, by definition, existence and reality are in God's definition. They're both predicates in the definition of God. Mm-hmm. Whereas Kant's trying to say that existence is a property,
right?
Which is not the argument that Anselm gave.
Right.
So I think that's a straw man.
Wouldn't by definition, too, God not be a physical being if God was perfect? Because physical existence is inherently imperfect and flawed.
Well, what's so that an assumption?
God would have to be an idea.
Well, physical doesn't mean reality.
Yeah. So
but then, getting to this here, this would be a more accurate description of God as an analogy than a car that actually existed or that was real, because having physical existence means to be flawed.
This God thing brings up a lot of tough arguments.
Yeah, but they're important.
So to God existing more as an ideal, like Aristotle said, a thought, thinking. Well,
but thoughts are still, I think you would say thought is still real. That's actually interesting to bring in Aristotle here. I think that the basic idea, though, is that there's existence isn't a property, because it's not the same as these other kind of properties. Or being green or square or you know, weighing 2 tons or whatever the properties the thing has. Existence is something which applies to things and objects together.
Yeah, it's an implication.
But we also
change that to real.
But the idea of real doesn't necessarily mean physically real. But if we put
now you're talking about this description that you just gave. This is a description of your car.
Yeah.
So all this exists because it's an idea as well as it's on the board. So it exists. My car exists as well as the properties existing, if merely as an idea. Now, whether or not it's real is a property, because you could say not only does this exist on the board as an idea right here, but it's also in the parking lot.
Uh-huh.
So that's the issue at hand. Anselm is saying is real as well as existing are predicates in the definition of God.
Well, actually, this is a good segue to Ganello's perfect island argument.
I think we shouldn't necessarily assume God is a noun either.
Is a what?
God doesn't necessarily have to be a noun, and that's the common assumption, but God would be more akin to a verb or an action there.
Okay, maybe we say that for the Eastern, this discussion of Eastern religion. It sounds very Eastern. So here's a famous counterexample, actually, from a contemporary of Anselm, another monk, Ganello. And so Ganello's argument, he wrote a book called A Response to Anselm. Anselm, all these Latin books are, you know, monologian and proslogian. And there, and you've got bits of them in the text. Well, Ganello wrote his response called on behalf of the fool, right? So Anselm starts out, the fool has said in his heart there is no God, and I'm going to show how that guy really is a fool. He believes that he believes something that's contradictory, that couldn't possibly be true. And so Ganilla says, well, here's my argument on behalf of the fool. Here's the fool side of the argument. And he says that Anselm, his argument, it proves too much. Because he says, imagine I tell you about the perfect island. And it's got sandy beaches, and it's got, beautiful weather, and you sort of give all the perfect qualities of the island. And then he says, well, you might doubt whether my perfect island exists, you skeptic, but you have to admit that the perfect island exists in your mind, because I just told you about it. And if it exists only in your mind, it's not really the greatest conceivable island, right? Because the greatest conceivable island would exist not only in your mind, but in reality as well. Therefore, the greatest conceivable island exists. Right? So he's following the same form instead of being, using the word island. So he says, imagine this perfect island, right? The greatest island imaginable. Well, if you follow Anselm's logic, the greatest imaginable island would have to exist. But obviously the greatest imaginable island doesn't exist. Therefore, there's something wrong with Anselm's argument. So it's kind of a reductio ad absurdum argument against Anselm's reductio ad absurdum argument. Yeah.
I'm just going to point out a quick flaw on that.
All right.
That island, besides not being conscious, is not all-powerful or all-knowing because it's an island. It's not a being. So if it's not all-powerful and all-knowing, then it's not inessentially greatest. It can't have the property of being greatest.
It's the greatest conceivable island, though.
So, but you're saying greatest conceivable island minus being able to think, being able to create, being able to make decisions, being able to blah, blah, blah. So it's the greatest, but it can't do this and this and this and this and this. I think that's a contradiction by definition.
Yeah, so you could say, well, okay, maybe we should add some more attributes to the island.
Is it a thinking island?
Yeah.
Is it a benevolent island? Is it just a metaphor for God?
So after a while, if you start thinking about the island, you think about if the things that could make the island better. You think, well, what if the island was conscious, and what if the island was benevolent, and what if the island, was a creative universe, and what if the island wasn't a material island, which is imperfect, but it was a spiritual island, and then pretty soon, as the islandness drops out, it starts to look a lot like God,
yeah.
And so. Anselm's argument is for the greatest conceivable being, not the greatest conceivable type of being. And so it's illegitimate to try to draw a parallel and say, well, what about the greatest conceivable turnip, or the greatest conceivable rutabaga, or the greatest conceivable projection system, right? It's not a parallel argument. It doesn't follow Anselm's logic. He's talking about the greatest conceivable being or the greatest conceivable existing thing. And he says only that being has to exist. And that being is the being everyone understands to be God, not these types of being. He doesn't say that every type of thing has a greatest conceivable instance of it, but that the greatest conceivable existing thing must exist, and that is God. Yeah.
Would God have to have every property?
Every property which would make him greater or more perfect.
Would that every property that could ever be in all of existence through all of time for any reason at all, God would have to have that, because to not have one property, God would.
Only properties which make him better. So it's unlike the Eastern idea where God has all the properties.
Oh.
And you see the verse vision of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita is sort of everything sort of rolled into one, the good and the bad. And the ugly.
Well, then that would make a not God again. If there were things that he, properties that he didn't have, these properties could be classified into not God.
Well, the not God sounds like we're getting to the Eastern stuff again. I want to say that for later. One last argument. This is the modal version. So the modal version of the argument says, if God's existence is possible, then it's actual.
And this is about sort of possible worlds. And so it's a similar idea using modal logic. And then, but there's an argument that comes against this, which says that, and this could actually go against Anselm too, maybe God's existence isn't possible. So if God's existence isn't possible, then it can't be actual. So is it, and so if you can find a kind of flaw in the concept of God, an internal contradiction, or a conceptual problem, then that might keep things from getting off the ground here. Or in Anselm's language, you might say, maybe God isn't conceivable. In other words, maybe God doesn't exist in the mind at all. You might think he does, but really the concept is logically contradictory.
Then how can we think that makes sense then?
That's just too good.
That's like saying, imagine a four-sided triangle.
Well, I think the idea is that you can't...
No.
You can say the words four-sided triangle, and some people might attach sense to it. But well, if you kind of think through it...
Well, no, they understand four sides, and they understand what a triangle is.
Well, sometimes you have, like, hidden contradictions, though, that take a while, take some digging.
Triangle aside.
The idea is there's some hidden contradiction. Like, you think about the concept of omnipotence, and some people have argued the concept of omnipotence is incoherent. Could God create a rock so heavy he could lift it? Anyway, that's all we have time for today, so we'll do the cosmological argument on Tuesday.